You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with David Elliott. He's talking to me from Oxford. David, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
To introduce yourself to our listeners, but also to get into what you're doing right now, can you tell me what you are working on at the moment in Oxford and in what capacity?
Well, I got 5 grandchildren, so that's one of the reasons I'm in Oxford. I brought to me a whole, I'll be polite, a big load of papers and work on various projects I'm working with. I mean, the first thing is I'm finishing off a book, which is called Art and Trousers, Tradition and Modernity in Contemporary Asian Art. So this is coming out next year. It's huge. And I'm now at that stage where it's all written, just reviewing it and getting it to work, which is incidentally a complete history of metaphorically and symbolically and actually of trousers, as well as looking at modernity and tradition in contemporary Asian art. I'm working on a Bill Viola exhibition in which will open in Guangzhou in China, southern China, in September. And I'm also working with David Madala for a show which I hope will open in November this year, looking at the whole of his career from the 50s on to the present. So that's more or less what I'm up to at the moment. There's a few other things, but we'll see.
So let's talk about your book, because that sounds really interesting, and the relationship of, as you say, trousers to the subject matter. How do those two connect?
Well, the trousers are obviously a symbol. Well, people think they're a symbol of Western domination, colonialism, all the rest of it. At a certain point, they are. But the oldest trousers that are actually surviving ones are found in Western China, of course. They're about just over 3,000 years old, preserved in the salt desert. And they weren't worn by Chinese people. They were worn by 6-foot-tall, blue-eyed, blonde-haired people who had obviously come from somewhere far west of there. So it's about cultural shift and transmission. It is about colonialism. Of course, it's about gender as well. It's about power. It's about ideas of barbarity, because, I mean, Chinese spent for about 1,000 years, well, for a very long time, actually, they thought people wearing trousers were either working class or barbarians. They were very rude about them. So were ancient Greeks and Romans. So there's a lot in there, which also reflects, it works as a very good metaphor and allegory symbol for relationships between Eastern and Western, Northern and Southern art, and particularly in the contemporary field. When people talk about globalization, it seems to me that really they're talking about neoliberal capitalism. But I think trousers is another perspective on it.
I like that, but you also said you are discussing the history of trousers from China, as you just mentioned, up to the present, and that also is woven into your parallel text.
Yes, it is. It's a parallel text. It runs throughout. It sort of heads up the 3 sections of the book, and there's a section on absurdity. It's called the slippered pantaloon. It's taken from Shakespeare. But, of course, the figure of Pantalone in the Commedia dell'arte and the clown, the kind of ridiculous trousers. And I mean, many literary figures and a number of artistic figures have regarded the trousers as a kind of rather ridiculous thing. And of course, not wearing trousers is even more ridiculous. And this idea of turning the world upside down, which I think art sometimes does, and very rightly so, and needs to do more. Is a theme under the theme of the slippered pantaloon or absurdity, and really the absurdity of history. Things aren't fair. Things do run ridiculously, and morons rule the world very often. But there are a lot of smart people around, and they just really have to get up and do something about it. Any echoes at the moment?
So the. No, I'm following you. So the let's talk a little bit about that chapter on absurdity, because that seems to have, you know, more than one meaning in a context of art, of politics, of so many things today. In the book, how are you approaching absurdity through the lens of trousers and also art?
Well, I mean, to get it up to the modern time, very early modern. I mean, you've got the whole phenomenon of the sans culottes in the French Revolution, they're actually not without trousers. They didn't like culottes, which were breeches, so aristocratic breeches. Yet they define themselves by what they're not. They're not wearing breeches. They're actually wearing pantalons, trousers. Which only workers had been wearing before. At the very same time in Britain, you have the invention of the modern trouser in reaction to what's been going on in the French Revolution by a guy called Beau Brummel. And he's credited with inventing or having his tailor make these very sleek, chic, rather tight-fitting all the way down trousers that don't finish at your knee but go right down. But more closer to our time, I mean, there's Vladimir Mayakovsky, his poem, A Cloud in Trousers, which is like a lot of his early poems, both revolutionary and a love poem about yet another love affair that has gone wrong. And he's saying that he'll be crazy, be like a man raging like meat. But if you want me to, I can be gentle like a cloud in trousers. So it becomes a kind of an image of ridiculousness. And just think of Charlie Chaplin or the people in the circus or the pantomime, the Commedia dell'arte, always lots of lewd fun around trousers or their presence or not presence or them splitting or falling down, all this. And it's about lèse majesté, about people making fun of power. And I think it's very important to be able to do that, not just as a safety valve, as it happened, I mean, in the European Middle Ages and in Eastern cultures. Just think of the stories of the Monkey King or Indonesian shadow play. You have these trickster figures, these joker figures who come up, and they turn all the gods and the rulers on their heads, and they make fun of them. And people laugh, and they feel better, then they're back to the shitty things as normal. I think also now, I mean, we don't want to be sold this story of normality, that actually things have to be bad. They don't have to be bad. And so the trouser becomes something which is much more analyzed and much more aware of and used strategically and is tailored strategically for really not to let power run away with itself and actually to be accountable. Mm-hmm. So that's... It follows on after Mayakovsky. There's a great quote from Nabokov, the American-Russian journalist, about in one of his later novels, a figurative father figure, which he's always obsessed by, actually dies. He has a heart attack trying on a pair of trousers, and there's a wonderful description of that. And then there's a number of artists. I mean, there's Paulo Rego, a Portuguese artist who did this whole sequence of works of little girls doing different things to dogs. One of them was opening their mouths, another one was lifting her skirt in front of the dog, another one was forcing trousers onto the dogs. And she said it reminds her of fascism, this kind of behavior. And her working in Portugal and the UK, they're very strange works. And then also on Kowara, I mean, also known in America in that he emigrated to live in America in the 60s from Japan. And he's best known for his date paintings and sending these telegrams, you know, I am still alive. But when he was in Japan, right, he was making really strange paintings. They were kind of surrealistic reportage on what he felt was happening in Japan then in the 50s, early 50s. He didn't like it at all. Partly the Americanization of Japanese culture, but also the fact that the crazy people had taken over the asylum again, and that it was really out of control, capitalist people who had no moral quality. And there's a pretty amazing painting from 1955 called American GI. It's called Black Soldier. Sorry, the title is Black Soldier. And what you see, it's actually a shaped canvas, and you look up straight at it, but what you're looking at is up a very, very narrow drain, so you just see the soles of these huge pairs of boots, and then you go up these spindly legs, and he's wearing a pink trousers, so you see this crotch in the middle of the painting, and then just tiny body and no head at all. It just disappears. So I mean, he'd been looking at Siqueiros' work. I mean, and that's one of the things, the way how David Alfaro Siqueiros, the Mexican painter, had been using for shortening in his mural painting. He'd been impressed by that. There'd been an exhibition in Japan just shortly before he made it, so trying something out with that. But it was it's a very strong work. So, I mean, the thing is, the whole book is not literally about trousers. I mean, it uses trousers as an image. First section is about different modernities and the kind of absurd way that they develop and how power relates to art and artists in different ways, and the different ways in which artists react to it. So there's regional texts. One is about the Ottoman Empire and how it moved into the Republic, the art, first modern art in Turkey going back into the 19th century, and how it develops into the 50s under the Republic. There's an essay on Tibet, one called Bye Bye Kitty, which is about Japanese art now, and a number of other areas, Indonesia and others. And then the second section of the book is just called Stories. And those are monographic essays about individual artists. Same kind of concerns about how they develop what they're coming out of, the tradition and modernity, and how they use these two realities and how they perceive them, where they're coming from, whether it's Manila or Bangkok, and how they develop their work and what they see they're doing. And then the last section is called Migrations. And that is about, again, it's about individual artists, but it's some artists moved away from their cultures. And only when they did that, when they were living in America or Britain or somewhere else, did they begin to decide to understand how either Japanese or Chinese or whatever other nationality they were, how they related to their own cultures. They only learnt it when they'd left it. And this is by no means an uncommon phenomenon, and it's one of those things, I think, which a lot of people who've migrated or been forced to migrate discover. So, in a nutshell.
That's very interesting. No, I'm glad you went through that. You know, when you were talking about absurdity and also how power, you know, relates to this, to artists' work, and some of the examples you gave made me think, of course, we're artists still working that way, right? And there's still power is still, or governments in many ways are still censoring and reacting, and artists are reacting. I mean, the latest I can think of is, you know, Vladimir Putin outlawing images of himself in drag. But there's it seems to be, you know, which is of course kind of absurd and crazy. But here it is in 2017, and this is still happening. You would think we'd be beyond that now, but it seems to be in some ways as big a struggle as ever.
Yeah, it doesn't go away. And I mean, these kinds of freedoms, you have to be vigilant about them, and they need protecting. I mean, the thing is about democracy, it doesn't fall off trees. You have to continually fight for it. And also you have to continually be trying to think what it is, because in my book, Western democracy, you know, developed since the European Enlightenment, it hasn't really developed. It's not there to serve the people. It's still only serving a minority. There's no reason for poverty. There's no reason for starvation at all. Yet these are realities that we see around us, and other things are at foot. You know, governments are there to govern. They're not there to privatize. I say this in Oxford, in Britain, where a conservative government does little else but try and privatize. But it seems to me to be axiomatic and obvious, but obviously to a lot of people it isn't. They don't want governments to govern. They want the law of the jungle back.
Right. Yeah, it's things keep changing. I think we should talk a little bit about your show with Bill Viola. That must be an exciting show to mount. And how big is that show? And how do you approach an artist as iconic as him? And he's really, you know, is such a pioneer with video work. And since in his lifetime, there's been, you know, so many more video artists and advancements, and you know, the field has become huge. So how do you approach putting his work up?
Well, I first worked with Bill in 2005 when I was head of the Mori Museum in Tokyo, and we did a show. I think it was about 18 works. And I got to know him pretty well, and him and Kira, they worked together. And I was actually, I kind of got into this project in the middle of it. Because I just recently been asked to advise, it's not exactly a new space, but it's a space that's constantly developing in Guangzhou, which is, it's not just a museum, it's an arts district. And this is one of the things I find interesting about it. It's about, I think, 14 hectares, between 12 and 14 hectares. So this is big. I'm sorry I can't do acres, but it's a big site. In the center of the city, near the river, and there are probably about 50-odd buildings on this site, of which 7 are used for visual arts, for public purposes. So they're not private galleries. It's called the Red Torii Museum of Contemporary Art, and it's actually not just one building, it's 7 buildings, and they can appear in different configurations. And they have a collection which they're building up, and they have a good work by Bill Viola in it. And sometimes they show bits of that, but also they're doing exhibitions. And there's a lot of artists who haven't been shown. They're showing both Chinese artists and other parts of Asia artists, but also Western artists. And there's a big demand and a big need for people to see this kind of work. So the exhibition that I'm working on, I think, is about 16 works, and we're going to show some a bunch of earlier videotapes as well in the program, and some of the very longer ones also, and also making extensive catalog in Chinese and English, translating some of the older interviews. And some of the best things have been written about him. It's really going to make available to people in China the first time a good body of literature in their own language on Viola's work. So it'll have a big impact, not only in the place itself, and it should get on an average, I mean, at least 500 people a day, and maybe a lot more than that at the weekends, maybe 2,000, something like that. And who knows, it may even be a lot more than that. The capacity for audience is pretty huge there.
That sounds like an enormous place. And so the work that you're showing of his, is this really a survey show, or is it set up in terms of his career?
It goes back to 1977, but it skips some bits. I mean, it's focusing mainly on from 2000 to now, but the videotapes from the 70s and 80s, and there's also, but the installations are mainly from 2000. So it includes the Tristan works, Marta, the recent one that was put into the St. Paul's in London, some of the walking ones, the desert ones. It starts with Chatt El Jadid, which is the first one they did in 79 in the desert in Tunisia. And then it continues with some of those which they made in maybe about 8 or 9 years ago. And so there's it gives a very strong impact on his work. And it goes from the visceral to the, to I'd say, the kind of expressive. So it certainly slows down people's time frame. And that's something Viola's always been very concerned about, and very, I mean, adamant about, that when you enter his work, you need to enter his time. Otherwise, you just won't get it. Just kind
that's
of chill
true.
Down.
That's true. That's what I think of when I think of Bill Viola. Is staying there to watch a work and it really holding my attention and as you say, moving into his sense of time, and that's something that you don't often see in work that's on video. You walk into a gallery or a museum, there's a video work running, and you can come anywhere into it, but often leave anywhere into it, and don't often, well, that's my experience anyway, don't often have quite the kind of grip that Bill Viola has on you with that sense of time, which is so unusual.
Yeah, no, I think that was one of the things in which he was very much pioneering, and also the sense of the self and consciousness. What is self? What is consciousness? And then working with the vagaries of the medium in its early days. I mean, it's not so old video, and they, of course, using tapes of different kinds, and even the cameras. You know, you kind of get a glare or a burn on the cameras if you had too bright a light. You won't have that nowadays. But and he was playing with that kind of thing in the early 80s. I mean, working with the Sony development labs in Atsugi in Japan, they let him play with their new equipment and that kind of thing. So he was starting then working with the kind of glitches or the vagaries of the equipment, and now he's trying to push the suppliers and the equipment providers, particularly since the invention of these big flat screens, actually to provide more definition and a kind of more plasticity, a greater depth in the images. So, I mean, his concerns, of course, changed over 40 years as an artist.
And how many works are being mounted in this exhibition?
Well, it's 15. Excuse me, 15 installations, and then there's a program of videotapes, which is a fairly short ones from the 70s and 80s. And then there's two longer ones. I do not know what it is I'm like. I think it's 86, and then Hatsuyume. And that one is about 90 minutes, and then Hatsuyume, which is 50 minutes, I think. First Dream, which is from 83. So those will be special screenings for those, where people can come at a particular time and they sit through it and get the whole thing. So it'll add up to, I don't know, 20-odd works by Bill in the end. But the installations, it'll be about 13, 14. So it's a major show.
David, it sounds very exciting. And, before I ask you the last question, I just want to say, you seem to be tireless. You've been mounting an enormous amount of exhibitions in your career, moving all over the world and now going to China and back and forth. It seems like you're putting out an incredible amount of energy and aren't slowing down or stopping at all.
Well, one does get a little older. what's important for me is writing and writing about what I've been involved with, and it's the main theme, I guess, in what I've been doing, is that I decided quite early on as a curator And I was lucky enough to become director of the Museum of Modern Art in Oxford when I was 27. I mean, there wasn't any money. It sounded very grand. It wasn't that grand at all. But it did give me the possibility of deciding. I didn't have to persuade some deadbeat that I had to do something. I could take the decision. And this was great, because one of the things I decided was that that it was, firstly, I mean, the contemporary art world, as I looked around me, looked very much like a white boys' club. And it was all white boys, and they all lived in Western Europe and North America. And I just thought, well, this isn't a gene pool, actually, I want to be swimming in too long. There's a lot more out there. And are we just saying that the only work worthy of significance, of considering today, is that made there? And of course, people said, "Well, there's a discourse going on. Don't you realize there's a discourse?" I said, "Yeah, sure, but for me, the discourse is okay, but and it's important. There's always been discourses of different kinds. But in the end of the day, if you're going to look at work, and I found myself as this director, so I felt I had to take responsibility for what I was going to show, and why do I show that and not that? I had to think that I'm showing it because I think it's really good." And I'm saying, do we only see good art made in a few places? That's crazy. You know, look at the history of the world. It's crazy. So I started looking elsewhere, not neglecting the West at all. I mean, I wanted to create a platform in which you could have, this is in the early 80s, we'd shown Pollock. Jackson Pollock with MoMA, who did a great show called Drawing into Painting in 1979. At the same time, I mean, that came immediately after a show of Alexander Rodchenko, where I borrowed the work from the family in Moscow, which you weren't supposed to be able to do, but I did it. And it worked. And then we did a show of Jose Clemente Orozco from Mexico. And of course, Orozco, when he was a young artist, was really blown away by Orozco's work and was very much influenced by it, as he was by Krishnamurti's ideas, mystical ideas, and by Native American Navajo sand painting. And all these kind of fed into over the years, and these Freudian, Jungian psychoanalysis fed into the famous paintings he started making towards the end of the 40s. And so all these things mixed up, and then you jump and you see that people are making incredible things in different parts of India, and it's just as contemporary as anything else, and some of it's really good. And so once I sort of picked up on that, I just thought, well, I'm going to keep, I'll keep running with this, and I haven't dropped it.
You sure haven't. Well, it's exciting to hear about, but the book and the shows that you're mounting. Before we go, I want to ask you the question I ask everyone. What are you reading at the moment? It could be off topic, what you're reading to your grandchildren or anything at all.
Oh. Well, I've just given my eldest granddaughter a book of Lewis Carroll letters and limericks and things that are not in the Alice books, but other ones. And it's an old book from the 20s. Illustrated by H.E. Bateman, who's an interesting illustrator. But anyway, that's by the way. I like, I'm really love books, and I have a lot of them. And I as much as I collect anything, I collect books. And anyway, what I'm reading now is a paperback. It's by a Pakistani artist called Mohammed Hanif, and it's called A Case of Exploding Mangoes, and it's it was written, I think, in around about 2006, 7, 8, something like that, and it's a kind of satire about Pakistan in the military period, General Zia-ul-Haq, and it's a kind of crazy, it's kind of better than magic realism. It's more violent than that, and I'm halfway through it, and it's pretty good.
David, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your new work.
Well, thank you. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.